This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Tuesday, Donald Trump announced his third run for the presidency at Mar-a-Lago in what he'd have called a low-energy hour if he hadn't been delivering it.
Our country is being destroyed before your very eyes.
This on the heels of a week-long defenestration of MAGAism and its leader by the press. 14 candidates endorsed by Trump, who once said that with him in charge, we'd all get tired of winning, lost, leading to the best midterm result for a president in decades. Since then, the pundits have been asking,
is Trumpism over? I mean, the donors are running away, the Murdoch media are moving away.
Donald Trump's moment has come and gone. That window has closed.
This is a deeply damaged ex-president like I haven't seen. Now we're talking about him being a mixture of Warren Harding, Andrew Johnson.
Trump is a joke. He's lost the House, the Senate, and the White House. He's lost the popular vote twice.
And I'd like to think that the Republican Party is ready to move on from somebody who's been, for this party, a three-time loser.
But if the GOP is ready to move on from Trump, it'll be tougher to move on from Trumpism. Tom Skoka wrote this week in the New York Times that it's difficult to, quote, declare defeat for a movement that is built around refusing to accept defeat. He said that though some may call Trump a loser, they haven't yet gathered up the courage to find another less Trumpy way to win. Even so, Trumpism is over is the dominant post-midterm political narrative. Of course, political reporters were singing a different tune prior to the vote, something about an inevitable red wave and a democratic climate that could be described only as bleak, and I mean only.
The economy now a top issue in the midterm elections less than 6 months away, with Democrats' chances looking increasingly bleak.
A new poll from ABC News and the Washington Post explains why the midterm landscape is so bleak for Democrats.
A final CNN snapshot of the midterm climate, and it is beyond bleak for the Democrats.
As the president and the Democrats remain in complete disarray ahead of the midterm.
Oh, I forgot about Dems in disarray. That was very popular.
You have to view the New York Times as the outstanding news organization of our era. That is why it's with enormous respect for its influence that I've noted the things where in politics it has seemed to consistently steer U.S. media discussion in an unfortunate direction.
James Fallows has been writing about the jarring gap between reality and the predictions of political reporters for 40 years. He also writes the Substack newsletter, Breaking the News.
As soon as the very first results came in on Election Day, which were from those gerrymandered districts in Florida that Ron DeSantis had set up and that flipped Republican, the New York Times put out an early edition whose banner headline was, GOP collects early wins in pivotal vote. And the two above-the-fold stories, one was an explainer saying, allies wonder why America can't fix itself. And the other one was saying Democrats faced intense national headwinds. They were so spring-loaded to interpret what was going on that even on election evening, as people were voting, in fact, for the best incumbent results in 50 years in midterm elections, they were prepared to interpret this as why can't America fix itself?
As you noted, what happened in reality appeared to be entirely at odds with what the political reporter cadre across the media had been preparing the public for. So how did the coverage of these midterms compare to prior election cycles?
There are two standards of comparison that I find interesting. And one is an admittedly unfair standard, which is how this is going to look in, quote, history, unquote, because it seems already clear that some of the fundamentals of this election, for example, a very strong vote for women based on the Supreme Court's Dobbs ruling and the changed abortion landscape, and a sense that on economics, it wasn't strictly the price of gasoline, which we heard about ad infinitum, but also the job market, which was very strong. Joe Biden's speeches about democracy, which were widely ridiculed by the press, actually seemed to have gotten some traction. And almost all of the election deniers and sort of Trump weirdos, if I can use that category for a lot of the candidates, they lost. Leading up to the election, it was all prices at the pump, Biden is unpopular, hangover from Afghanistan, which remember a year and a half ago was going to be the end of his presidency. There was a really fundamental mismatch between what seems to have been going on there and what our experts were telling us.
I'm wondering where these narratives come from.
I would enumerate three streams. One is whatever has happened to political polling. It seems as if all the fallibilities of polling, whether it's not reaching enough young people, not getting enough answers overall, people not answering honestly, they seem to have accumulated in a number of really large-scale errors. There seems also to be a sort of self-sustaining narrative within a number of the political press corps that my good friend Timothy Krause wrote about 50 years ago in his seminal book, The Boys on the Bus. Yeah, this was actually the election of 1972, and Tim Krause wrote The Boys on the Bus about the way a narrative would evolve. And I think back then, a guy named Walter Mears was the AP correspondent. People would say, okay, what do you think the narrative is after a speech by McGovern or Nixon or whatever? And you'd say, yeah, the speech was X, and that became kind of the narrative. And we have the modern era of that, I think, where certain narratives, Biden is unpopular, it's all about prices in the pump, Trump is unstoppable, they became the modern version of The Boys on the Bus.
That single word analysis has prevailed in all the ensuing elections. Al Gore was a liar. George W. Bush was a dummy. Hillary Clinton was an emasculating...
It's unlikable. And also her emails.
Oh, and her emails. That was a narrative that the Times made great use of. And I mark that down to fairness bias. It's a kind of both sides-ism, and it's because the legacy press is still upset about being labeled liberal, starting with Richard Nixon all those years ago, still trying to overcompensate to report two issues as if they're equal when they aren't and never were.
It's just a matter of observed fact that more people who go into the press as their career are politically liberal than not. You know, why do you go in this line of work and not become a financier? And out of self-consciousness of that reality, and also because of relentless criticism from the right of, oh, you're liberal bias, a lot of mainstream organizations want to make sure they have on Marjorie Taylor Greene along with Jamie Raskin, as if these were people of comparable weight in what they're saying. And I think that was especially the case in the 2016 election, where it seemed so, quote, certain, unquote, that Hillary Clinton would win, that mainstream outlets wanted to show that they were fearless in criticizing her, thus her emails.
Now I'm curious about the narratives that are emerging post-midterms. In the New York Times, I saw a really good opinion piece by Tom Skoka, who described the temptation by some reporters to declare that, quote, the strength of the MAGA forces is ebbing at last. The calendar leaf is turning over on the Trump era. I have heard so many times, this is the thing that'll sink it. That's the thing that'll get them, and so on.
On the one hand, do you like how I'm setting this up? On the one hand, there are indications of some greater normalization of politics. One might have guessed 2 weeks ago that if, for example, Carrie Lake were losing in Arizona or Dr. Oz or any of these other characters, Blake Masters, there would have been all these widespread protests and election denial and things we saw after Trump's defeat in 2020. And so far, we haven't seen that as you and I are talking. So that could be some sign of normalization.
I just think that that is a weariness with Trump and not an exhaustion with Trumpism.
Yes, and, as we say, yes, and this kind of Trumpism has always, always, always been part of the American makeup, ramped up or damped down by different leaders at different stages of history. Obviously, it's been ramped up to a truly rancid degree in the last 6 or 8 years, as it was by George Wallace a generation ago and others before that. Mm-hmm. And so if even Fox is turning its back on Trump and see him as sort of past his sell-by date, the sentiment will still be there. And the question is whether somebody else will emerge with the same talent of ramping it up.
So what are the post-midterm narratives that you think maybe people ought to take a moment?
The post-midterm narrative I'm against even more strongly is looking instantly to the 2024 lineup. If there were a single thing I could change about the political press corps, it would be to reduce by about 90% the effort, space, assignments, energy, et cetera, to what is going to happen 2 years from now or 4 years from now, and switching that instead to what is happening right now. If you look back to any previous presidential election and try to correlate what is said right after the midterms with what happens 2 years later, there's basically zero correlation between who people think is strong and weak and rising and falling, and just forget about it. And instead, tell us more about what it was that made people vote the way that they did. So, for example, a thought experiment. You recall how after Trump's election, some of our leading newspapers we won't name had what we think of as the guy in the diner crusade of saying, oh, how did we miss? People have voted for Trump by this hair's breadth margin. And we could maybe have not the guy in the diner, but the woman in an office narrative of what it was that shifted the vote as fundamentally that made things not turn out the way all the reporters thought over the last couple of months. And I'd like to hear from more of the people about the complexities of people's motives in voting how they did.
Talk to me a little bit about the business of prediction. You wrote the book Breaking the News 26 years ago about how strong this impulse is.
I understand why people in our business, the politically minded media, like predicting things. It's always interesting to think who has the combination of intangibles and luck that might end up with that person being president. That is the fun part of our game. The challenge is that it's both cheating and it's not useful. It's cheating because it reduces everything to an area where people in our business are the supposed experts, rather than what are the economic fundamentals? How does this person work with colleagues? What has this person done? What kind of personal characteristics does he or she have, et cetera, et cetera? So it moves the playing field away from all the vast 3D reality of life to a flattened 1D reality of politics. It's also just not useful, and it's not even as accountable as being a Las Vegas sports bookie. The sports bookies or the crypto investors, they finally have to cover their losses. You don't have to cover a loss if you are saying person X is going to be president and that person is not. You just say, well, in a surprising result, blah, blah, blah. And it's just a surprise.
And it's contrary to expectations because it's these political pundits that establish what those expectations are.
It was like an Olympic ice skating move of landing a quadruple axel or whatever. The same exact people who a day before the election were writing about the red wave were the day after the election saying, which many people had expected to turn into a red wave instead, blah, blah, blah. Not saying many people, including me. I think in many other fields, there would be at least a pause to say, let's recalibrate here.
You know, we once reported on a study that found that the number of appearances that a particular pundit had on television was inversely proportional to how accurate their predictions were. The more wrong they were, the more likely they were to be invited back. No one wants to hear on the one hand, on the other hand. Someone saying with great passion, something extreme is just better TV. So when it comes to print, have you seen any publications who have self-corrected post-midterms?
Let's take an example of Andrew Sullivan, once my colleague at The Atlantic for a while, and he did very forthrightly do a I was wrong piece after the midterm election, saying that all of his woke narrative was excessive and rising crime narrative was excessive, and he hadn't taken either abortion or democracy seriously enough. I've seen a couple of other people do limited versions of that. But institutionally, it would be worth it for our colleagues, again, speaking you and me in the press, to say the kind of after-action report you get in medical operations or whatever, when there's a problem, to say, what went wrong here and how can we account to our public for things where we didn't do what we thought we were doing?
So you're recommending that the press just take a time out from predicting.
Yes, I'm saying that I had actually a little formula, which was for an assignment editor or a writer, for every three times the impulse comes up to say, let's follow Ron DeSantis, let's follow the next six people who might be contenders in 2024, for every three of those impulses, shunt off two of them to a story about the actual world of the now, of its culture, of its economics, of its technology, of something else, of its sustainability. Don't predict the future, which you don't know. That is my timeout suggestion. It might be 9 out of 10, but I was gently suggesting 2 out of 3.
And the chances of that? Any predictions?
Well done, Brooke. I see how you talk about landing the quadruple axel. I would predict 0 out of 0. I hope that in surprising results, in results that many observers did not expect, we'll see a diminution in predictions.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Brooke, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Coming up, Twitter in disarray. This is On the Media.